haven't seen this guy in years. Well, actually, when was the last time I seen him? Split Lake. He came to Split Lake once.
Yo, man, that was a winding, desolate highway.
That's right, yeah. Lots of bumps on that road.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Roots and Hoots, a podcast project produced by the Legacy of Hope Foundation. Since 2020, we've been gathering, laughing, learning hard truths, and sharing in community conversations with Indigenous peoples across Turtle Island. Each episode, we learn something new, and we're excited to be sharing this journey with you. Roots and Hoots is about connecting with and celebrating Indigenous peoples' contributions to their fields of study, work, and cultures. We also speak with allies who share how they are furthering the work of reconciliation in Canada. To learn more about the Legacy of Hope Foundation and the work that we do, please visit legacyofhope.ca.
In this episode of Roots and Hoots, host Gordon Spence sits down with one of his favorite musical talents, Errol Seaweed Randville of the band Seaweed. The two Manitoba boys discuss all things music, from Errol's early days of growing up in a musical family, including Seaweed's road to success and artistic process. He has received some pretty big lessons in life, and we are so honored to learn from him today. Please enjoy this special episode of Roots and Hoots.
Hello and welcome to another podcast episode of Roots and Hoots. I'm your host, Gordon Spence, and today my guest is Errol Randville, a.k.a. Seaweed. Maybe, Errol, you can start with talking a little bit about where you come from, your family, and like your family background, and that sort of stuff.
I come from the bush in rural Manitoba. Bush. We didn't grow up on the res. We grew up a small little Métis settlement. There's 12 in my family. Wow. I was 16 in my dad's, no, 19 in my dad's family, 16 in my mom's family.
Wow.
So there's a few relatives. Me and my brothers all played guitar. Well, we started with guitar. There was no drums or bass guitar in the bush at that time. So we all learned to play music on a little beat up black flat top guitar with the strings about probably 3/4 of an inch off the fretboard. But we managed to make music with that thing.
Okay. We'll get into that a little bit more later. I wanted to ask you if you, what language do you speak? Are you Métis? I think you're Métis. And did you speak any Mi'kmaq in your household?
Well, it's funny because we were raised Métis. My dad only spoke French up until he was 17 years old. He learned Cree first, and then he learned Soto. So English was his fourth language.
Wow.
And then when I turned 60, I made application under Bill C-31, and I'm actually a treaty through my grandmother. My dad's mom, last name is Nipinak, and they're from the Pine Creek Reservation here in Manitoba. So that's my roots.
Did anybody in your family attend residential school?
Yes, my older brother, Sterling.
Sterling.
Very good experience. Brought some of those problems back home with him. And I think we all started to use alcohol in the same fashion that Sterling did, although we didn't need much coaxing.
Okay. I heard about Sterling. He had a band, didn't he, called Sterling Randville and the Randville Trio?
That's correct. He was the first band in the family. Well, actually, we were already up and running, but when we came to the city, there was not much places for us to play because at that time, we played in the Indian Métis Friendship Center. Back home, we played in all the dance halls, little towns around where we grew up. But Sterling started the band, Sterling Randville and the Randville Trio. Randville Incorporated. The Randvilles.
Yeah.
And they actually, there was two bands in the family for a while. My brother Brian had a band on Main Street at the Commercial Hotel. About a block over was the Winnipeg Hotel. My brother Sterling had a band there. These are my two older brothers. I was too young to be in the bars at all at that time, but there was two Randville bands operating at one point there.
Okay. What's that like? What side of your parents do you inherit the music from? Your father?
Neither.
Neither.
Neither of them played an instrument, no.
No kidding. How old were you when you started playing, singing and playing music?
I was probably 7 or 8, maybe. I played, first time I ever played a Christmas concert in our little one-room schoolhouse across the gravel road there. Back home, my brother Wally actually showed me where to put my fingers on the guitar and showed me how to strum. And I learned a George Jones song called Don't Stop the Music.
Yeah.
And so I went across there on Christmas, the Christmas concert, when I was, I'm pretty sure I was 8 years old. And I could barely reach my arm over the guitar like that. And then, but I figured out where to put my fingers in, and I sang that song. And then something really magic happened at the end of that song. People clapped their hands.
Yeah.
And then I was hooked. And then I always want to hear that sound again.
The applause.
Clapping their hands. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That got you going.
Yeah, it's an incentive.
Yeah. You shared the stage with some big names over your career. Who are some people that in the music industry that you played with?
Well, the first one that comes to mind when I get asked that question is Waylon. Waylon Jennings, because out of all the people that I met, I sat with Willie Nelson too for about 4 or 5 hours in his bus after the Craven Music Festival in just outside Regina, Saskatchewan. But Waylon, we played, I think, 4 shows in total with him at various different spots around in North America. And he was a friend of mine.
Yeah.
I could honestly call him a friend.
Yeah.
Because he was the most down-to-earth, natural kind of guy that I had met out of all those people in the big-time music industry.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever been to Nashville? Have you ever played there?
Yeah, we played Nashville. We played the Hall of Fame Inn. They jokingly referred to it as the Hall of Shame Inn. right in the center of the row there in Nashville.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever meet Kris Kristofferson?
No, I have not. I probably would have had occasion to, but plans had changed and that opportunity came and went.
How many brothers still play with you in the Seaweed Band?
My brother Wally.
I thought Don was your brother too. The drummer.
Don was actually our first cousin. We raised him as brother. He's still here. He plays locally.
Yeah.
He's got a full-time job that is important to him.
Yeah.
And so when we get shows on weekdays and across the country that, you know, like we're leaving for Fort Smith, Northwest Territories on the bus. Coming December 13th, we'll leave for the 15-16 show.
Yeah.
And then on the way back, we'll stop at Cold Lake on the 18th. Yeah. And then we're playing back here in Winnipeg on the 21st. So it would have taken him away from his job, like all the time indefinitely. So
he's kind of part-time. Do you have a different drummer that travels with you now?
Yeah, we have a full-time player now. The Dudium family, who's been part of our operation from right almost the beginning, Clint Dudium, who has recently passed away.
Right. Yeah.
Tom Dudium was in our band for 5 years since, he was in the band before, but he was in full-time once when Clint passed away.
Yeah.
He's just recently moved on. But their nephew, their brother Keith, who was the drummer in the Younger Brothers band. That was the Dudium Brothers.
Yeah.
Keith Dudium, his son. So we call him Keith Jr.
Yeah.
He's the full-time drummer of the Seaweed Band.
Okay.
Ayaya songs are about our histories. Ayaya is an Inuit-owned firm that tells our stories in many languages across Canada. They are experts in publishing children's books, usually in syllabics, and they also do large multi-language projects like the reports of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Commission. If you need help getting your stories into classrooms or homes in Cree, Inuktitut, or other Indigenous languages, check them out at ayaya.ca. That's A-Y-A-Y-A.ca.
How did you come up with the name Seaweed? Where did that originate from? Because, you know, people used to call you Seaweed, right?
The age-old question.
What's that?
I said the age-old question.
Okay.
Comes up in pretty much every interview I've done since I was 16 years old. But, you know, there is no real, well, there is a stand pat answer, I guess. You know, the answer is who knows.
Who knows, but, yeah.
But it's a nickname I got. You know, you got seven brothers, and I think it started off with Sawman, and then teasingly became Seahorse and Seaman, and then Seaweed all of a sudden. And for some reason or another, Seaweed stuck. There's no ocean near Eddystone, Manitoba, that's for sure. No.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a nickname you had, right?
That's my nickname, yeah.
And then it carried on to the band.
That's correct.
Yeah.
1975, we raised a big neon sign in the back of the Winnipeg Centennial Concert Hall and had the Seaweed Band on there. So that,
yes. Yeah. I remember going to see you at one of those places. That could have been it. I was living in Winnipeg in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
That would be. And we used to go see you at the Savoy and the Manor, and you even had a cabaret once.
The Savoy Manor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a club for a while. I had a club from 1992 to 1997 in Winnipeg.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I had a club in Edmonton, Saskatoon, Thunder Bay, and Fort McMurray.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. What inspired you to move to those places, like especially Edmonton? You were in Edmonton for a while.
Yeah, I was there for a little while. Yeah. Not the club, just the club. Like, Plus NHL hockey.
Okay. Before the Jets came back, eh?
I had season tickets for the Edmonton Oilers.
Wow. You got to see Gretzky play?
Yeah.
In the fall of 2010, you were involved in a major car accident where several people died, including your wife. This had to be the most tragic event in your life. What did you do to recover from the tragedy and help you begin your healing journey?
Yeah. That was tough times.
Yeah.
Four teenagers were killed that night out from Opaskwa Cree Nation in the Paw. And my wife right beside me, our dog, Max.
Yeah,
it was, for some reason, I survived that crash, where if you saw the vehicles, you would never believe that anyone walked away from there. But I was in the hospital for 66 days.
Wow.
And a lot of people came to see me, like like the premier of the province came to see me.
Mm-hmm.
Elijah Harper came to see me. A couple of the ex-presidents of the Manitoba Métis Federation came to see me. Loverboy showed up one morning. They were rehearsing at the casino down the street, the McPhillip Street Station.
Yeah.
They came to, to cheer me on. Just a really, I could name off like dozens and dozens of people who came to visit me.
Yeah.
And without exception, every last one of them said the same thing to me. He said, Errol, you survived for a reason. You'll need to find that reason. And whatever it is, attend to it. And so that stayed in my head, and became like sort of a vision quest for me. And I did have a vision, which coincidentally I'm just starting to work on it now. Because we have one of the very first Indigenous premiers in Canada, the Premier of Manitoba, the Honorable Wab Kinew, just got into office a couple weeks ago. So that opens up a lot of doors for me to move forward with a global tourism project that I want to do here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. I think that's one of the things. The other thing, of course, is music. when I was in the hospital, I had written songs and I wanted to get back into the studio. I couldn't even sit up. My sternum was collapsed. I had a broken vertebrae in my back. My right leg was crushed. I no longer had an ankle or a heel on my right leg. My left leg, all the bones were broken in my left foot. So I wasn't really going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if I didn't have music, I don't even coming home. I came home in a wheelchair on December 12th, 2 weeks away from Christmas, 2010. And empty house, quiet house, you know, and not looking forward to Christmas. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, it's a long ways back. I mean, you either, I always think about Shawshank Redemption. You either get busy living or get busy dying.
Yeah.
And I chose to live. I wanted to live. As a matter of fact, I got a couple of dogs because I always loved dogs. I always had a dog. We lost our dog in the accident. I went to get a dog and I picked up two by mistake and I ended up taking both of them.
Okay.
One passed away three years ago, this coming February.
Yeah.
And one that I'm going to put down in about an hour and a half.
Really?
He's upstairs right now, cancer. Ate him up. So after I finish this interview, I got to bring him to the vet. And
that's hard. That's hard. Yeah.
But he's been with me and he's been part of the inspiration that has kept me going.
Losing his health?
Yeah. I had to take care of the dogs. So I had to stay up and running. And I have a passion and love for dogs. So that was another thing besides the music. You have to, you know, it's always something that you love that's going to get you up in the morning and get you going, get you started.
You know, after decades of successfully recording and performing music, in 2021, you released your first book titled Run As One, My Story. How has this creative process different from writing music?
Well, music is a different animal. You know, I remember seeing Merle Haggard. He had just won a songwriting award in Nashville. And the interviewer was asking, what inspires you to write? You're such a prolific songwriter. What is your process for writing songs? And Merle answered him, you know, I don't believe I've written any songs. He said, I believe all songs are written. And some of us are privileged to hear them and write them down. Made the hair in the back of my neck stand up when I was watching that interview because I thought I was the only one.
You feel the same way?
Yeah. I thought, it was like saying something that I thought was almost like a secret, you know?
Really?
And I mean, I hear them. I hear the music. I hear the instruments. I hear the whole song. The words. If I don't get up and write it down or record it or something, it's lost. And I've lost, who knows, you know, thousands of songs because I'm too lazy to get up at 3 in the morning.
Wow.
Now I have my phone right beside my bed. So when I hear the songs, I grab my phone no matter how tired I am. And I just sing groggily into the phone. It sounds terrible the next day, but at least I keep the melody and I keep the idea for the song and some of the lyrics. Possibly I saved that song.
Ayaya songs are about our histories. Ayaya is an Inuit-owned firm that tells our stories in many languages across Canada. They are experts in publishing children's books, usually in syllabics, and they also do large multi-language projects like the reports of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Commission. If you need help getting your stories into classrooms or homes in Cree, Inuktitut, or other Indigenous languages, check them out at ayaya.ca. That's ayaya.ca.
But that's that process. Writing a book is kind of a whole totally different animal, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You want to get a message across, you know, of something worthwhile reading. And I'm a reader. I'm a prolific reader. I read novels. I've read thousands and thousands of novels.
Yeah, like me.
I mean, every night, that's how I go to sleep.
Do you write your own songs? The music, put all that stuff together yourself?
Yeah, I do it myself, yeah. Wow. And I've had a producer for, like, the actual studio part. I'm not an engineer. I don't know what these buttons are for, that button. Yeah. You know, I don't know that part. But I hear all the songs, so I play them with my acoustic guitar. And I play, you know, this is where the solo is, you know, this is where the bridge is. And then the piano player puts the piano on, and then the bass player puts the bass track on, and the you know, guitar player, etc. And that's the process. But I mean, I bring the song completely finished, like the finished product, and then we produce it.
Yeah, songs like, I've always loved your music, and I've always loved your songs. A couple of them come to mind, like Evangeline. You wrote that?
No, I didn't write Evangeline. Evangeline was written by Robbie Robertson. He's from the
Robbie Six Robertson. Nations. Oh, okay, yeah.
Six Nations band in Ontario.
Yeah,
and he was the one that catapulted us to number one back in 1980. So he's
that
the guy.
Song.
Yeah, he's the guy to put us on the map, so to speak. And we use that momentum from that number one song for the rest of our career.
Yeah.
Right until today.
Yeah, you still plays.
Yeah, every audience that we stand up and perform for, there's somebody yelling in the eye, play Evangeline.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. I love so many of your songs. Loving You is also a favorite. You've won numerous awards and produced many albums over the many years you've been performing. Is there one event or an award that has special meaning to you?
Oh, there's a few, of course. It's been a lot of years.
Yeah. Yeah.
What comes to mind when somebody asks me that question is a show we did at the Edmonton Maximum Security. And that is a reserved audience. But that was a special event. Yeah, for us, because lifers, you know, that's different world for those people. We played three songs and nobody clapped. I was starting to sweat, you know, wondering what's going to happen here. Like, do they not like us or what, you know? And then we played a song by Johnny Paycheck called 11 Months and 29 Days. And then one big guy in the middle, you know, and then they all started clapping. And then we did the concert. But at the end of the concert, they presented us with a little plaque, and it was shaped like the Keystone of Manitoba, the province of Manitoba. And on there, they said thank you to the Seaweed Band for taking the time to come and perform for them at Edmonton Maximum Security. That to me was probably the most important memento that I picked up through the years of performing, because it was coming from those folks, you know, and from the place where they find themselves in the world. And I really appreciated that. And I really appreciated the, you know, the privilege of performing for them.
I read somewhere that you produced about 20 albums.
Yeah. We're putting the finishing touches on the 21st album. It's going to be called Spirit Rising.
Wow, incredible. Any Juno Awards?
We were nominated for Junos. I never did one.
Yeah, that's prestigious in itself, you know.
I wear it as a badge of honor. I've never received a Juno award.
Yeah.
And yet we play all over the country.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad. But, you know, you have a lot of fans, and that would, you know, disagree with that.
You know, when I think about that, I think that we've got the nod of the people.
Yeah.
And that's much more important to me than the nod of the industry.
We're going to switch gears here a bit, talk about something else. But I mean, I could talk for probably another hour asking you a whole bunch of questions about you and your music. You are one of the founding members of the annual Manitowabi Festival in Winnipeg. Can you tell us a bit about, like, how this started, and you had a vision, and has that vision been kept? Is it still there?
Not necessarily, but you know what? There again, the Manitowabi Festival and the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards that went with it, we created all of that. And there was, again, there was a time, Eric Robinson, who's a Cree from Cross Lake here in Manitoba, was the deputy premier of the province at that time, similar to Wab Canoe getting in right now a couple weeks ago. But Eric Robinson was in government at that time, so he tapped me on the back to do that portion, because he was the culture and heritage minister at the time. So we pretty much put our heads together and built his whole ministry during that 8 years that they were in office. And that was one of the projects that we did. That was just one of them. Manitoba Festival and the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards. The awards piece has since fizzled out and died, which is really a disappointment for me. But it also opens a window for us to start another music awards that will honor all the Nietzsche artists in the country.
Yes.
But it's still going. Like there's a powwow and there's a Manitoba Festival. Not necessarily what I had envisioned. I had hoped that at some point it would gain enough momentum to become self-supporting, but that didn't happen. I had moved on, so I'm looking forward to getting back into the game and creating another global tourism project.
Yeah. Okay. The truth and reconciliation is important to you and probably to most Indigenous people in Canada. You have described returning to music as a way of giving back to the community that gave you so much. Why is the process of the truth and reconciliation important for all Canadians?
Well, I think it's absolutely necessary, really.
Yeah.
I was there when Judge Murray Sinclair read off the 94 recommendations. I was sitting in the audience right in front of him. And, you know, when you look at all 94 of those things that should happen, that to me is like a small beginning. What happened here in Canada is a tragedy, to say the least. And I think optically, on a global sense, the rest of the world, especially the European nations who are Western countries, that look upon, you know, what happened here in Canada and the U.S., I guess, to another degree. They look at it and they have, I'm sure, because I played down there. I toured in Europe. I even toured in China.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, but I did quite a bit of touring in Europe. And to them, the Aboriginal people or the Indigenous people of Canada and the U.S., it's somewhat a romantic thing for them. You know, they see us as something very special. The European people, they really value the Indigenous people of North America on a completely different level.
Wow.
Like I took some little dream catchers, you know, not very big, you know, and my suitcase when we went for that particular tour. And I asked the lady, you know, just make me a box, you know, just not very big, so it'll fit in my suitcase. And she made me some earrings, like feathered earrings. And, you know, they used to bead those big lighters. And I took those with me to Europe. And the second show we did in Austria, I was at a table there, and the people there, and they were saying, authentique, authentique. And they were talking in German, and I couldn't understand. So I knew at the next table, there's a guy, I knew he spoke English. So I asked the guy, I said, what are these people saying to me? And he said, they want to know if an Indian person made that stuff.
Oh.
And I said, yeah. And I started nodding my head. Like I said, yeah, this is all made by, and right away they lined up, they formed the line in front of me. In 2 days, I sold everything along with my CDs and cassette tapes at that time.
Yeah.
$9,000 we made in the first 3 days. We had four days off before the next concert in Southern France. So me and my son took off to Paris. We had $9,000. We had money.
Yeah.
We took the train to Paris.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the, what, I mean, the audience, when you're paying for in a concert, how is it different there than it is, like, let's say you play for an audience in Winnipeg?
Oh, it's huge because, see, to them, we're a novelty. They don't see Indian people walking around in London, England, walking around.
Yeah.
We stayed in Switzerland. They don't see Indian people.
Right.
They see Pakistani people. They see Punjabi people, Asian people, Japanese people, you know, all over Europe. But they never see a Canadian Indian, I guess, to them, because they're going to say Indiana Schnur. That's what they say in German. And so for us to be playing, even though we're playing our songs, which are not much different than any other Western country rock band, you know, but for us to be there in the first place and playing and entertaining them and doing it very well, to them, it's like a whole, oh man, they just, like, you know, the applause was thunderous. Like they thought it was a huge treat to those people.
Well, yeah, splendid. Well, see, we, Errol, mm-hmm. We've come to the end of our podcast here. I want to thank you so much for joining us, for doing this for us. Before I let you go, I want to ask you, maybe you can, we'll allow you to do a plug here, for booking Seaweed bands for events, weddings, or whatever.
Yeah.
Do you have a website,
or a
contact number?
Yeah, seaweedband.com. It's there's no hyphen. It's just CWEED in the band.com or .ca.
Yeah.
And so our phone number, my cell number is on there. So, and the last couple of years, we've sold out the whole summer. Like, we couldn't put any more shows in there because of the distance and the travel. But we were playing weeknights, like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays, where we haven't played for. And all of this is post-COVID. It seems like after COVID, everyone was, you know, cabin fever. Everybody wants to have a show. It's great for us.
Yeah. I've been talking to Errol Ranville, the Seaweed Band, the front man for Seaweed. I want to thank you, Errol, for doing this for us, and much appreciated, and good luck with all your future travels, endeavors, whatever you decide to do.
Thank you, Gordon. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Roots and Hoots is a podcast project produced by the Legacy of Hope Foundation. For episode show notes, please visit the podcast description and make sure to like, subscribe, and leave a review. For more information about the work we do, please visit legacyofhope.ca.
Our rhymes and give our thanks. They've got to know they can rise above 100 years of quiet fear and press for the mark. Got you run as one now, it's begun.
Hey, ha, hey, hey, ha.